Unfortunately, I can't answer any of those questions, Tyler, because I don't have the answers. I can tell you that apparently something went wrong with the mission. I can tell you that the Army believes your father is alive. They just don't know where he is. Was he captured? Don't think so. If he'd been captured, I doubt he would have been able to email you. They could have captured him after he emailed me, Tyler pointed out.
Yes, they could.
Sean said, there's something else you need to know. Tyler looked at him apprehensively. What? A friend of mine who gave me the information about your dad was shot today at a local mall. Michelle and I were actually there. There were three gunmen. We managed to subdue all three.
We managed to kill all three.
Michelle corrected.
Before they could kill us.
You killed people? Tyler said, looking astonished. At the mall?
I'm afraid so. And a police officer was also killed.
And you think this had something to do with my dad? Tyler said slowly.
We don't have any other active cases, and the shooters did look like, well, like former military, although they carried no ID.
Tyler looked at Sean. That bruising on your face, was that from what happened? It's nothing for you to worry about, said Sean quickly. Will they be able to find out who the men are? If they're in some database somewhere, the answer is yes. If they're not, there's no guarantee. So they came to the mall to get you and Michelle?
They wanted us to come with them. We just politely declined.
Tyler looked back at her, his face pale as cream. I'm sorry. I never wanted anything like this to happen. Michelle gripped his shoulder.
It's okay, Tyler. It's not your fault. It comes with the territory.
Tyler glanced anxiously at Sean. I hope your friend gets better. Thanks, said Sean. Me too. They all sat in silence for about a minute. Finally, Tyler said, I'm not sure what to do now. Sean said, well, the most pressing issue is with Jean gone, what happens to you? You're 16. I don't think you can live on your own. But nobody knows that Jean is gone, not really, said Tyler. Michelle said,
an excellent point.
She looked at Sean.
He can stay with one of us.
I have to go to school, said Tyler. That we can manage, said Sean. He looked at Michelle. I think we need to double-team this. My place with both of us there. When Tyler's in school, we can do our job. Michelle nodded.
Sounds workable.
Tyler said nervously, move in with you guys? Hey, maybe I could stay with Kathy's family, he added hopefully. And maybe put them in danger, pointed out Sean. Tyler's face fell. I didn't think of that. There's just one other thing, Tyler, said Sean. What? Did you try to contact your dad after you got the email? Tyler shook his head. I thought about it. I wanted to, but his voice trailed off. Michelle said,
but you were afraid he might not answer.
Tyler nodded his head. And if I try to email him now, other people might find out. They're probably monitoring my emails. You said he was on this important mission and everything. Probably, said Sean. But you can write him from another email account, and you can use your code so he'll know it's you. How do you know about our code? Tyler asked, looking suspicious.
Didn't we tell you? We rock at code breaking.
Sean added, well, at least we know someone who rocks at code breaking. But then they could break the code too, persisted Tyler. Anything's possible, but we think it's worth the risk to contact your dad and see what he says. We can't be sure it's my dad, not just from an email. No, but I don't think a face-to-face is a possibility right this instant. For now, we need to get your things and take you where you'll be safe. Tyler glanced up at him. Where I'll be safe? Sean looked directly at him. Yes, because after what happened at the mall today, we need to take every precaution we can. Right now, none of us is really safe, Tyler. Chapter 27. The man had a problem, a large one, but not unsolvable. 4,800 pounds was a big part of it, but not all. At least it had gone where he had planned for it to go. But Sam Wingo was still out there. And then there was the son, Tyler Wingo. And on top of that, he had lost 3 men at a mall. He had assets, but they weren't infinite. And it wasn't like he could hire the replacements he needed quickly and quietly. It all took time. That was the thing he didn't have much of, time. He had a lot left to do, and the minutes were ticking fast. The window of opportunity was just that, a window. It closed at some point and would not come back. All elements of his plan had to come together at the exact right time. At this moment, he had the two faces imprinted on his brain, Sean King and Michelle Maxwell, former Secret Service, now private investigators. They had royally screwed up his plans and cost him valuable assets on the ground. Problems all around. He didn't like problems. He liked solutions. He would figure out the solution to each of these problems, including King and Maxwell, and get the mission back on track. He had every incentive to do so. He had been planning this for a long time, assembling the pieces he needed. But soon, if things went as they should, he could finally let it go. He took a cab to the airport and shortly was on a jet climbing into the sky. He arrived at his final destination and took a moment to slip on the lanyard with his ID badge and creds settled against his chest. They marked him as a government contractor full of security clearances. He had once served his country in uniform. Now he was really serving only himself. He picked up his car at the airport garage and drove to the Big House, as he always had referred to it. He passed through security. His creds would get him into many places here, all the ones he needed to get into anyway. He walked down one long corridor, turned left, and kept going, passing military personnel all along the way. Since he was no longer in uniform, he never had to stop and salute. But there were so many enlisted personnel and officers here that they were designated no salute zones. Otherwise, personnel would be spending all their time doing that. He nodded to a few he knew but said nothing. Everyone was bustling to get somewhere else. It was just that sort of place. No time for much chit-chat. He knocked before entering the office that was situated on the last corridor he had turned onto.
"Enter,"
said the voice. He opened the door and looked around. This was the outer office of the Army's Assistant Secretary for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology. The Assistant Secretary was a civilian now, a retired two-star who ran a program that decided how billions in defense money would be spent in the Middle East. There had been scandals and fraud and waste in this sector during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Investigations and commissions had ensued, and folks had lost their jobs and their careers. Some had gone to prison. The current Assistant Secretary, Dan Marshall, was in his 60s and had a sterling reputation as a scrupulously honest administrator. He had come in and cleaned house, and things were running a lot more smoothly by most accounts. The woman behind the desk looked up at the man, smiled, and greeted him. He asked for Marshall. She picked up her phone and buzzed the interior office. A few moments later, Marshall came out of his office. He smiled and came forward, not with an extended hand to shake, but with both arms out for a hug.
"Alan, my favorite son-in-law, welcome back. How was your trip?" he said.
Alan Grant smiled, hugged his father-in-law back, and said, "Interesting, Dan, interesting, but productive."
"Come in and tell me all about it," said Marshall.
Grant followed him into his office and shut the door. He would tell his father-in-law some, but of course not all. He looked over at the shelf that housed an array of photos. His gaze locked on one, and it always did. Marshall followed his look and smiled sadly.
"I still miss your father greatly, even though it's been so many years now. I was friends with your father long before you and my little girl were even born. He was the sharpest cadet in our West Point class."
Grant walked over to the photo and picked it up. His father was in his dress greens, his fresh oak clusters on his broad shoulders. He looked happy. That didn't last. Not after he became a civilian and had gone to work in D.C. Grant put the photo back and turned to Marshall.
Yeah, I still miss him too, maybe more than ever. At some point, Alan, you have to let it go. Leslie's been telling me you've been on edge lately. Everything okay?
Your daughter is a great wife, Dan, but she worries too much about me. I'm a big boy. I can take care of myself.
Well, you came back from Iraq alive. No one is questioning your toughness.
Lots of very tough soldiers died over there. I was just one of the lucky ones.
I thank the Almighty you were. Don't know what I'd do without you, and Leslie would be lost.
She's a strong woman. She'd be okay.
Let's get off this morbid talk, Alan. But you really do need to move on from what happened to your parents. It's been over 20 years.
25, said Grant quickly. In a calmer tone, he added, and I am getting over it, Dan. In fact, before long, I think I'll be completely over it.
That's good to hear.
Yes, it is, thought Grant. Chapter 28. The cargo plane bumped and bounced along crappy air at 20,000 feet as it made its way over the Atlantic. Sam Wingo sat tethered to a canvas sling seat. It had proved impossible to obtain a ride on a commercial aircraft coming out of India. Once he had made his way to New Delhi, he had spent a day changing his appearance as much as possible, and then had identification documents created with the new image on them in a back-alley store full of computers and high-res printers. Still, making his way through airport security had been problematic. He had heard rumors on the street that there was an official search on for an American soldier. It was believed that he might have sought refuge in Pakistan or India. Well, he hadn't been seeking refuge. He was trying to get the hell out. After a day of trying every way he could think of to leave the country, an opportunity had presented itself. It had cost him some bribe money, but in Indian rupees the price was not bad. Thus, he was now sitting in his canvas sling seat, trying to stop himself from being thrown into the sides of the fuselage and keep the little food in his belly from coming back up. Nothing made sense right now. He didn't know who had taken his cargo or why. He didn't know what the U.S. government knew about it. He did know that they blamed him and that he would be arrested on the spot if they could only find him. He didn't know that he had just received an email on his phone because he had turned it off when the cargo plane lifted into the air. The email would have no response from him, at least for the duration of the long flight. All the hours in the air would give Wingo some time to think about what he would do once he got back to the States. His options were limited. He had no doubt his son was being watched. They might have intercepted his email to Tyler. Hell, they might have his kid detained somewhere. That thought ate at Wingo so badly, he thought he might go berserk at 20,000 feet. This mission had been a cock-up from the get-go. He had been in the crosshairs from the very first, and he wondered how he had never seen it coming. His guilt would have been established by his decision not to come in as ordered by his superior. In their minds, he was already court-martialed. They probably thought he had taken the cargo for himself. Well, part of him wished he had. He could use it right about now. But he didn't have it. Tim Simons from Nebraska did, whoever the hell that bastard really was. He was fairly certain his name wasn't Tim, and he seriously doubted he was actually a Cornhusker. Wingo knew he had to get into contact with his son at some point and explain what had happened. Then he had to get a line on the hijacked cargo. If he could recover it, then maybe he could save his reputation and avoid spending the rest of his life in a prison cell at the United States Disciplinary Barracks in Kansas. As the plane received a hard jolt from the turbulent air outside and dropped about 100 feet, Wingo also received a jolt of sanity to his mind. Everything he had just envisioned doing was impossible. He would not be able to get anywhere near his son. He had no way to get a line on the cargo. It was probably worlds away by now, and he had no means to get to where it might be. For all he knew, the police would be waiting for him when he landed in Atlanta, and he would spend the rest of his life in prison. He put a hand to his head, closed his eyes, and prayed for a miracle. "Nothing," said Tyler. He had been staring at the computer ever since he had sent an email to his dad. He had used a Gmail account set up by Michelle. While his dad wouldn't recognize the account sender, Tyler had used their code to write the message. He hadn't said much, though, in case others were somehow watching and had cracked the message. He looked up at Michelle. They were at Sean's house in Northern Virginia. Sean and Michelle had decided it was too risky to let Tyler go back to his home to get his things, so they had driven directly here. Sean had left to go to Tyler's house and pack him a bag. Michelle had been constantly checking her watch for the last 30 minutes. Tyler said, "You can call or email him."
"No, then he'd think I was checking up on him."
"But you would be."
"Exactly. He can get prickly about that."
It was dark outside now, and Tyler's belly was rumbling. Michelle must have heard it because she said,
"I can whip up some dinner, although I'm not much of a cook."
"I can help," replied Tyler.
"Wait a minute. Kathy told me that you can cook, that you taught her mom a few dishes, in fact."
"I used to help my mom. She was a great cook."
"I'm sure she was, Tyler,"
said Michelle somberly. She brightened and said,
"And for what it's worth, when you get out into the real world, the ladies will really appreciate that talent."
"You think so?"
"Oh, trust me, I know so. There's nothing more attractive than a man with a spatula and a plan."
Then something occurred to her as she looked out the window.
"You missed swim practice."
"It's okay. We don't have any meets coming up. I can slide for a bit."
"But will your coach call your stepmom or anything like that?"
"I already emailed him, told him I was sick. He knows about my dad. He'll cut me some slack." They decided on breakfast for dinner. While Michelle tried not to burn the bacon, Tyler whipped up a complicated omelet with numerous ingredients, buttered grits, and rolls he made basically from scratch in under an hour. "Sean cooks too, right?" he asked her.
"Yeah, he's really good, which makes up for the fact that I can barely crack an egg properly. But how did you know?"
"His pantry and fridge are full of some really cool ingredients, and the layout of the kitchen and the types of appliances and cutting knives he has shows it." He held up a knife. "This is not for amateurs, and neither is that food processor over there."
"You'd make a good detective. Kathy said you were smart, straight-A student."
"She did?" Tyler said, trying to hide a smile.
"Yes, she did."
They sat at the kitchen table and ate. Michelle had coffee while Tyler drank orange juice. They finished, rinsed off their plates, glass, and cup, and loaded the dishwasher. Tyler cleaned the rest of the kitchen while Michelle checked her phone for messages.
"Sean will be here shortly."
"Where has he been?" asked Tyler.
"At the hospital to check on Dana, I suspect. And he was going to scope out a few things while I stayed here with you."
"I can skip school tomorrow."
"No, it's better that you keep to your routine."
"And what about Jean? When people realize she's gone?"
"We'll cross that bridge when we come to it, Tyler."
"It might be soon."
"It might be."
20 minutes later, headlights hit the front window. Michelle peeked out and saw that it was Sean getting out of his car. A few seconds later, he came in looking disheveled and depressed. He was carrying a large duffel bag and handed it to Tyler. "I think I got everything you needed."
"Did anyone see you?"
Michelle asked. "Parked a block over and approached the house from the rear. Left the same way. I checked the front street for surveillance, but didn't see any."
"Did you go back to the hospital?"
He shook his head. "I'm not family, not anymore. From what the surgeon said in the waiting room, the next 48 hours will probably be critical."
"Well, there's nothing more you can do about that,"
said Michelle briskly. "I've certainly done enough with Dana, including almost killing her." That statement hung in the air like a ball of concrete, until Michelle said,
"Did you eat?"
"No, I'm not hungry."
"Tyler made a great dinner. We have some leftovers."
"I'm not hungry, Michelle," he said firmly. She sat and stared up at him while Tyler hovered nervously in the background.
Okay, Tyler has heard nothing back from his email, so what now? Did you exercise your little brain cells while you were gone?
I did, but I'm afraid not much came out of them. He glanced over at Tyler. I'm really hoping that your dad gets back to us, Tyler. Without that, we don't have much to go on.
Anything on the three guys at the mall?
I'm sure there's a lot. We're just not privy to any of it.
McKinney sure as hell won't be keeping us in the loop,
said Michelle dryly. All he wants to do is arrest us.
Or shoot us.
I've got a few contacts at the local police. They might know something about it.
Even a name would be helpful.
More than we have to go on right now. Tyler said, but if my dad contacts me, we might have a lot more to work with. Sean exchanged a glance with Michelle. Tyler saw this and said, my dad didn't do anything wrong, and he's going to come back here and clear his name.
I'm sure he would want to do that,
said Michelle quietly. Tyler scowled. But you don't think he'll make it back. You think he's dead, don't you? Sean said, the answer is we don't know, Tyler. We hope he's not dead. Tyler looked away. I did get one bit of information, said Sean. Michelle and Tyler perked up at this.
What?
What? They both said together. The name of someone at DTI who your dad worked with.
How did you score that?
Yeah, added Tyler. He never talked about his work to me. Friend of a friend. Michelle eyed Tyler and said, smiling,
Sean has lots of friends of a friend. He's very popular at parties.
Sean continued, your dad's co-worker was a woman named Mary Hess. You ever hear him mention her? Tyler shook his head. Like I said, he didn't really talk about work. Sean slowly nodded. Right. Well, I'm going to see her tonight. She might be able to tell us something.
I can go too.
No, you have to stay here with Tyler. Why don't we all go? Suggested Tyler. No, Sean said firmly. I have no idea if Hess will even give me 5 minutes. She sounded very reluctant over the phone. If we all show up, it might freak her out. Michelle said,
okay, that makes sense. I'll play bodyguard, you play detective.
Tyler said nothing, but he didn't look too happy. A bit later, Michelle walked Sean out to his car.
I'm really sorry about Dana, Sean, but it wasn't your fault.
Of course it was, but I don't want to get into that again. He fumbled with his keys. Michelle put a calming hand over his shaky one.
You have to just let it go for now, Sean. If you keep up this way, you'll be no good to yourself or anyone else.
I know, he said resignedly. It's just hard to shut it off.
Secret Service. Tunnel vision. Block everything else out. Like you said, these are dangerous waters. Bring your A-game all round, right?
He nodded curtly. A-game, right. Thanks, Michelle, for a gentle kick in the pants.
Anytime. I can also do the hard kick in the pants if necessary.
And don't I know it? He got into the car. I'll call you when I'm on my way back.
Okay.
He gazed at his house. A-game all around, he said. Including you. You've got the precious cargo. Chapter 29. After Sean drove off, Michelle did a perimeter patrol, then walked back to the house. She locked all the doors and made sure her pistol had a round in the chamber. She looked down at the kitchen table where Tyler sat with his school books piled everywhere.
Lots of homework?
She asked. Always lots of homework, he said dully. However, he made no move to open a book or pick up a pencil.
Shouldn't you be getting to it?
I suppose. He paused, gritting his teeth. Where do you think my dad is right now?
Maybe on a plane back here from the Middle East?
Tyler listlessly thumbed through some pages in his math textbook. Michelle doubted he was focusing on the formulas she could see on the pages. She eyed him more closely.
Before your dad deployed the last time, did he talk to you about anything?
He stared at her blankly. Anything like what? We talked about lots of stuff.
Anything out of the ordinary? It could have been something seemingly innocuous.
Tyler thought about this and then slowly shook his head. He told me to work hard in school and swimming, to mind Jean, and to keep out of trouble, stuff like that. Michelle nodded.
Well, keep mulling it over. Something else might strike you.
Michelle heard the noise before Tyler did. She pushed him down under the table and with one long leap reached the wall light switch and plunged the room into darkness. Her SIG was in her right hand. She blinked rapidly to adjust her eyes to the absence of light. Tyler whispered, "Michelle, what is it?"
"Someone outside. You stay there. Get your phone out. Tap in 911. If I'm not back in 5 minutes, call them."
"But..."
"Just stay down and stay quiet, Tyler. It'll be okay."
Michelle Crab walked out of the room, her gaze swiveling and taking in as much as her lines of sight would allow. She did not like noises in the night that she knew represented stealthy footsteps. Sean had neighbors on both sides of him, but there were buffers of trees on both those sides too. A nice little screen for felons to do their work. Michelle's immediate thought was that the three stiffs at the mall had friends who would return to finish the job. She took a quick peek out the front window. A sedan was there that hadn't been before. She couldn't tell if anyone was inside or not. Her Land Cruiser was parked in the driveway, but she couldn't risk trying to reach it with Tyler in tow. She continued to watch out the window, all the while keeping her ears peeled for sounds of intrusion. She stiffened when she saw the man coming around the corner of the house.
"Shit,"
she hissed. She opened the front door and called out to him.
"Is there something you wanted, Agent McKinney?"
He turned and saw her. Her manner had been jocular. When she saw his face, her jocularity vanished.
"What is it?"
she asked. He came toward her. "Can we talk?"
"What are you doing here? How did you even know to come here?"
"We're DHS," he growled. "We do have resources."
"Sean's not here, but you can talk to me."
He nodded and passed by her into the house. She glanced over his shoulder and checked the perimeter one more time before securing the door behind her. Michelle called out to Tyler in the kitchen that things were okay. She flicked on the lights, and he came into the living room on wobbly legs. He flinched when he saw McKinney. "Who's that?" he asked.
"Agent McKinney with Homeland Security."
"Homeland Security?" said Tyler. "Why are you guys involved?" McKinney said, "We keep the homeland secure, like the name implies." He stared hard at Tyler and then shot Michelle a glance. "Why is he here? Damn, can't you guys heed a warning?"
"It's a long story, but Tyler is safer with us. So why are you sneaking around Sean's house?"
McKinney sat down and slipped out a pack of Marlboros. "You mind if I smoke?"
"Yeah, I do, and I know that Sean sure as hell would."
He put the smokes away and sat back. "Do you guys have any idea what you're involved in?"
"We're working on it. Any help you'd like to give us would be appreciated."
"An international incident," said McKinney, who didn't seem to have heard her. Michelle sat down across from him while Tyler remained standing and looked stunned.
"What kind of international incident?"
asked Michelle calmly. McKinney studied her. "I'm not sure I can answer that."
"Then why the hell are you even here? To tell us you can't cooperate with us? Trust me, we got that message loud and clear before."
McKinney cracked his knuckles. The dead guys were former military.
"All of them?"
He nodded. But they'd been out of uniform a long time and had gotten into stuff that men who wore the uniform of this country never should.
"Like what?"
"Drugs and gun running, for starters. And some militia activity with maybe some domestic terrorism thrown in. The list only gets longer after that."
"Do you think that's what this is about?"
"I don't think so, but I can't be sure." Michelle looked up at Tyler, who blurted out, "My dad wouldn't be involved in anything like that." McKinney turned to him. "He seems to be right in the middle of it, whatever it is."
"What was the mission, McKinney? What was Sam Wingo doing? We know he was delivering something, but it never got there."
"Who the hell told you that?"
"Does it matter?"
"It might," snapped McKinney.
"Look, we're both trying to get to the truth.
He looked at Tyler again.
Your old man contacted you, didn't he? Slipped you a coded message.
Tyler immediately looked at Michelle. She hesitated, but then nodded. Tyler said, yeah, he did, after he was supposed to be dead.
And what did the message say?
Michelle answered,
that he was sorry and wanted Tyler to forgive him.
You sure that was all?
Yes, said Tyler defiantly. I wish it had been more, but that's all there was.
Sounds like a confession to me, said McKinney.
Don't think so,
said Michelle before Tyler could say anything.
Why?
Just my gut.
McKinney snorted with derision. She ignored this and said,
what was he delivering? And was it just him?
It was apparently just him, which makes no sense at all considering the cargo, but then maybe the military does things differently.
So what was the damn cargo?
McKinney cracked more knuckles.
Every alphabet agency and all the uniforms are mixed up in this shit. It's big. Really big.
I'm sure it is. Big enough for you to get a call from the Pentagon and read us the Riot Act. But that doesn't explain why you're here. Like you said, you're DHS. You have lots of resources. You don't need to come to us for anything.
What you say is perfectly true, he said.
And still, here you are.
McKinney let out a long breath. I checked you two out some more. You and King. That's why I'm here. People I respect say you're both the real deal. That you can be trusted, that you're sharp.
Okay,
said Michelle wearily.
But why do I think one reason you're here is that you're having trouble getting straight answers from your side, and maybe there's a lack of trust going on?
McKinney hiked his eyebrows at this, but said nothing. Michelle said again,
so what was the cargo? Come on. The suspense is killing me, Agent McKinney.
McKinney glanced at Tyler, then back at Michelle. He seemed to have finally made up his mind.
4,800 pounds.
Michelle's brow furrowed.
That was the weight? Well over 2 tons?
McKinney nodded.
So what was it?
What do you know that weighs 4,800 pounds?
What are we playing here, Jeopardy?
Michelle snapped.
A nuke? Or a dirty bomb? Said Tyler anxiously.
McKinney shook his head.
No.
Too light for a tank or a plane. Bioweapons? Some off-the-rack centrifuges? A few hundred Al-Qaeda terrorists?
McKinney shook his head.
Okay, we give. What is it?
McKinney cleared his throat.
1 billion euros.
Chapter 30. John was seated across from Mary Hess at a restaurant in Chantilly, Virginia. She was in her mid-40s, attractive, with dark hair and a slim figure. She seemed to have a problem making eye contact with Sean. She wore glasses but kept taking them off and wiping the lenses with her napkin. Nerves all around, observed Sean.
So you worked with Sam Wingo?
He prompted for the second time.
This was shaping up to be like pulling teeth, he thought.
But in situations like this, patience was a virtue, even though it felt like an ulcer. She nodded.
Sam was a really nice guy. It was just...
She broke off, looking slightly dazed.
It was just what?
He put a hand across and tapped her wrist. Ms. Hess, I know this is hard, but as I told you on the phone, I'm working with Sam's son, Tyler.
Sam spoke of him all the time. He was really proud,
she said. I'm sure he was. Tyler's a great kid. But he's terribly worried about his dad.
They said he'd been killed in Afghanistan.
We don't believe that to be true. And I think you were about to say that you thought something was off about Sam, weren't you? She looked surprised at his observation.
How did you?
I'm former Secret Service. We get really good at reading body language.
Well, he just appeared one day at DTI. No one had seen him previously. No one that I knew had even interviewed him for the job. And while we're not that big a company, we do have certain protocols.
And these weren't followed with Wingo?
They didn't appear to have been followed.
What else?
He spoke Dari and Pashto, but not, well, Not at the level of the other people at the firm.
But I understood he was a salesman. He drummed up business for the company.
We don't need drumming, Mr. King. We're swamped. Even with the winding down of the wars in the Middle East, there's still a large military footprint. And commercial companies are starting to go there. They all need translators.
So business is booming and you don't need salesmen. So what was Wingo doing for you? At this simple question, Hess seemed perplexed.
I'm not really sure.
You're not really sure? You told me you worked with him. Her face paled, and for an instant Sean thought she might be sick. Take a sip of water and catch your breath, he advised. She gulped some water and wiped her mouth with her napkin. You okay? She nodded.
You see, he wasn't really working for us.
So what was he doing?
I was teaching him Pashto and Dari, at least building on what he already knew.
You were teaching him to speak the languages primarily used in Afghanistan?
In other countries in the Middle East as well, including Pakistan and in Iran, Dari is known as Farsi. It's a very useful language to know over there, along with Arabic, of course.
So, if he wasn't a salesman, and he wasn't qualified to be a translator, were you teaching him to be one?
No, we have immersion schools for that. What I did was work with him one-on-one, 3 hours a day, every weekday. I did that for nearly a year.
Did you ever do that with anyone else? She shook her head. He was a reservist headed to Afghanistan. Maybe he wanted to speak the languages?
But he wasn't paying us to do it. We were paying him a salary to learn the languages.
Sean sat back, obviously flummoxed by this statement. How do you know that?
Our company bookkeeper, Sue, is a friend. She told me, but the thing is, we were getting fully reimbursed for his salary.
Who by?
Some unit at the DOD. I'm not sure which. There are so many. But we were definitely getting paid back. It wasn't costing us a dime. Our company's owner is not known for his generosity. He wouldn't pay for an employee who had no duties.
Did you ever talk to Wingo about this? This unusual arrangement?
I was told not to. I considered him a friend because we spent so much time together. He told me about his son. I told him about my family. I was stunned when he didn't show up one day. I knew he was leaving for Afghanistan at some point, but I didn't know he had been deployed, and I didn't know he was in the reserves.
He was regular Army. I think you were helping prepare him for a mission that required those language skills.
What was the mission?
She asked in a whisper. Good question. I wish I knew.
You said you didn't think Sam was dead, but it was in the paper.
No, I don't think he's dead. Sean leaned forward. But that doesn't mean he's not in danger or trouble or both. Did he mention anything to you that might help me? Anything at all?
He told me he hoped to retire soon. He wanted to spend more time with Tyler.
Anything else?
Well, there was something strange right before he left DTI.
What?
He said he was going back to Afghanistan soon. I told him to be careful, that I didn't want him to die from an IED or a sniper, that I prayed he got back soon.
And what did he say to that?
He said that IEDs and snipers were the least of his worries.
Sean rubbed his chin. Meaning what? That something else even worse might happen to him over there?
I guess, yes.
Her features shifted to alarm at what this actually meant.
What other things could be worse than being blown up or shot?
There might be something. He confirmed some other information with Hess, and then left her there staring into her coffee cup. He was halfway to his car when his phone buzzed. It was Michelle. She filled him in on her meeting with McKinney. €1 billion, he said, his voice heavy with skepticism. That's about $1.3 billion US dollars at current exchange rates.
I'll take your word for it, and it apparently weighs 4,800 pounds, crate not included.
And why would McKinney come to us and offer up this information? Sean slid into the front seat and clipped his seatbelt on before starting the engine, the phone wedged between his shoulder and ear.
I think he feels hemmed in, not trusting anyone, meaning on his side, too.
Still, it was a stretch for a DHS guy to come to us and convey that sort of information. He could get his ass canned for that.
No argument there. I was as surprised as you are.
How did you leave it with him?
I didn't really. He just left and I got on the horn with you.
I'll be there in about 40 minutes. Hang tight. Sean put the car in gear. He didn't look in the rearview mirror. If he had, he might have noticed the red dot flitting across his forehead. Chapter 31. Alan Grant lowered his pistol with the laser sight on the Picatinny rail as Sean drove off. It would not be as simple as a trigger pull, although the time would come when it would be something that basic. He slipped his gun back into its shoulder holster and sat there with the engine running while he thought some things through. Mary Hess, a DTI grunt, worked with Sam Wingo teaching him how to speak languages of the Middle East. She was a dead end, but there were other trails out there that could lead King and Maxwell somewhere. He put his Mercedes sedan in gear and drove out of Chantilly, heading west toward the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. The roads turned from interstates to highway to state routes and finally to rural road switchbacks. He finally turned onto a gravel road, drove up a hill, turned left, and skidded to a stop in front of a small, ramshackle cabin. He climbed out of the car and checked his watch. It was nearing midnight. Time was meaningless to him. He had long ago ceased to operate on a 9-to-5 schedule. He popped the trunk and looked down at the woman lying there. Her hands and feet were bound with flexi-cuffs, mouth taped, eyes blindfolded. All these steps were probably unnecessary since she was drugged, but he was a cautious man. Cautious people, he had found, live to fight another day. He lifted her up and carried her to the porch. He set her down, unlocked the front door, triple locks, and a security system run off a propane-fired generator that also provided lighting. Picked her back up and carried her over the threshold. There was nothing matrimonial about the gesture. He walked into the back room where the window had been blacked out. There was a metal table in the middle of this room. He laid her down on the table, removed her blindfold, and stepped back. He took off his coat and laid his pistol aside. It would just get in his way. He turned on the overhead light. As he watched, she started waking up. He looked at his watch. Right on time. Jean Wingo's eyes fluttered once, twice, and then remained open. Her look was confused at first, and then she looked to the side and saw him. She stiffened, her eyes instantly filling with apprehension. Grant gently removed the tape covering her mouth. She said breathlessly,
"What are you doing?"
She looked around.
"Why did you bring me here?"
"To talk."
"You drugged me, tied me up, and now I'm lying on a metal table. You could have just called, for God's sake."
Grant could tell the woman's courage was returning. She tried to sit up. He put on a pair of leather gloves and forced her back down on the table. With her legs and arms bound, it was not a difficult thing to do.
"Please let me up."
"Not until we've talked. I need a debrief."
"Where are we?"
"In a safe place." He pulled up a chair and sat next to her.
"Can I sit up, please?"
He put an arm under her back and helped her to a sitting position. She eyed him warily.
"What do you want to know that I haven't already told you?"
"For starters, why did you leave?"
"Tyler hired these detectives. I got nervous."
"You left without permission. You signed on for the mission. You can't change the rules midway through."
"I understand that, Alan. I'm sorry. But conditions on the ground change, and I had to change with them. These detectives..."
"I have that under control. Your leaving has complicated things. Tyler is now with King and Maxwell. I lost 3 men to them. This all could have been prevented if you had spoken up and controlled Tyler. If he hadn't gotten suspicious, he wouldn't have hired anyone. He would have believed what the army told him, and that would be that."
"Wingo sent him an email."
"Which we know about. But it could have been sent by anyone, not necessarily his father. Again,
If you had stuck to the script, which had this contingency built in, it would have been taken care of.
Look, I'm sorry, okay? Every plan does not go smoothly.
Mind it, until now.
What, did you bring me here to torture me? Or kill me? How is that going to help things?
Again, Grant could tell she was nervous, but trying to cover that with bravado. No, and no. And it wouldn't help things. I just want to see if you have any useful information to convey. Then I will redeploy you. But you need to understand that you screwed up. There have to be consequences, Jean.
I think I more than carried my weight. I got designated as Wingo's bride. I carried this whole thing pretty flawlessly the last year. The kid never warmed up to me, and Wingo was Wingo. It hasn't exactly been a walk in the park.
I understand that. Just tell me anything you might have learned, and we can head back to town.
I left the house when things started to get hairy. I called you and told you what I was doing.
And I told you to stay the course.
Easy for you to say.
What else?
That's pretty much it.
Any more communications from Wingo on his son's email?
There was nothing. Wingo hasn't tried to contact him again.
She looked curious.
What exactly happened over there? You never said.
Wingo lost the cargo, but my people lost him. He's out there, probably trying to figure out what happened and attempting to get back here. He has made contact with his immediate superior. Said superior did not believe his explanation. He is a marked man. DOD is putting major resources toward finding him. We're, of course, looking for him, too.
So he won't stay out there long.
But we don't need the DOD to find him, because they might just believe that he didn't take the cargo. Then they start to look elsewhere. I want their focus on him.
So you need to find him first.
As you remarked before, easier said than done.
Then we better get to it.
Agreed. He pulled his knife, cut her hands and feet free. He flipped her his Glock 9mm. She checked the mag, chambered around, pointed it at him.
Sorry, Alan.
She fired the weapon. Or at least attempted to. But there was no bang and no bullet was propelled down the barrel.
Helps to have a firing pin, said Grant, who seemed unsurprised by her attempt to kill him.
He struck, the knife passing across her neck, severing all her major arteries. He backed away from the blood spray. Her gaze was on him, and he continued to watch her, waiting. Jean fell to the floor, and a few seconds later finished bleeding out. He stared down at her for a few moments. Consequences, Jean. He wrapped her in plastic and tied her up tight like a present. The dug grave was waiting in the woods a quarter mile away. As he put the last shovelful of dirt over the hole, he said a silent prayer and considered the fact that Sam Wingo was a widower for the second time. He doubted the man would care about that right now. He had other things to worry about. He walked back to the cabin, cleaned up, and got back into his car. He didn't like losing Jean, but some things were sacrosanct. You followed orders. You didn't make the rules up as you went along. There was a chain of command for a reason, a very sound, historically verified reason. And Grant was above all a disciplined soldier. It didn't matter that he no longer wore the uniform. It wasn't about something he wore. It was all about what was inside the clothes. Discipline, honor, respect, reliability, professionalism. Jean had violated all of these. He didn't have the option of court-martialing her. There was really only one option left. He had employed that option, but only after she had failed his loyalty test. He was a fair man. If she hadn't tried to kill him, she would still be alive. She had, and she wasn't. He drove on. He had a list. He had checked it twice. It was time to move the ball forward. He had 1 billion euros. He didn't personally need all of it. He just needed a tenth of it. But he believed
It would be money very well spent. Chapter 32. The next morning, Michelle dropped Tyler off at school. She said,
"If anything seems weird or if strange people show up looking for you, lock yourself in the principal's office and call me."
Tyler promised that he would, and Michelle watched him all the way into the school. She had never been a mother, and had never really even imagined herself in that role. But she felt like an overprotective mama right now. In fact, the weight of responsibility she felt was even greater to her than when she'd protected VIPs at the Secret Service. Go figure. She drove off and phoned Sean on her Bluetooth.
"Baby Bird has dropped off. Where do we go from here?"
"You think McKinney will meet with us again?"
"I don't know. He left his card. I can call him."
"Do that."
"Why McKinney?"
"We need official access, Michelle. He provides it. Otherwise, we are cut out of the loop and have no leads to follow up."
"He's not going to just invite us to the investigation."
"You might be surprised."
"What do you know that I don't?"
"Just call him. Noon at our office."
"What are you doing in the meantime?"
"Checking on Dana."
"But you said you weren't family."
"There are always ways."
"What do you want me to do besides call McKinney?"
"Play detective. I try to get a line on Gene Wingo."
"Okay. I'd say be careful, but I know you will be."
He clicked off. Michelle drove to Tyler's neighborhood. It looked just like thousands of neighborhoods that dotted the country. Working-class homes filled with working-class folks. Only this neighborhood was different. Certain people who lived here were definitely not who they appeared to be. Michelle knocked on the door of Alice Dobbers, the neighbor who had seen Jean leave the previous day. Dobbers came to the door. She was well into her 80s, short, and about 60 pounds overweight. Her legs and arms were swollen, and she looked to be in pain. She wore glasses. A hearing aid poked out of her right ear. Michelle explained who she was and what she wanted. She added,
"We're trying to help Tyler."
Dobbers nodded.
"I know. Tyler told me about you and your partner. I can tell you what I told him. Saw her leave around noon. My soap was just about to come on. Aren't many of them left, soaps, I mean, so I'm sure of the time. Just happened to look out the window. Commercial was on. Coffee. Don't drink coffee anymore. Makes me hyper and pee at night. I don't like hyper, don't like peeing at night. Too much effort getting out of bed. Tried Depends. Didn't like them. Felt like I was being born again. Not in a good way. Diaper, you see."
She slid her glasses halfway down her nose and stared knowingly at Michelle.
"I'm sure,"
said Michelle quickly.
"So she had her suitcase?" "No. First she put out the recycling. Guess she forgot."
"Forgot what?"
"Yesterday was trash pickup day, not recycling. Why they can't do it all on the same day, I'll never know. But I don't have enough time left breathing to worry about crap like that."
"Then what?"
"Then she came back out with a suitcase, popped the trunk of her car, put it in there. No overnight bag. Big sucker. Probably everything she owned. Don't see her coming back. No loss there."
"What makes you say that?"
Dobbers gave her another knowing look.
"I've been married for 57 years. Not to the same man, now. It was 3 of them, actually, but they totaled up to 57 years of mostly good times until they weren't. So I know about love. Know about commitment. Know it when I see it. Know it when I don't see it."
Michelle glanced across the street.
"And you didn't see it over there?"
"I knew Sam Wingo's first wife. Now, there was a woman in love and a man who loved her. Not the second time around. Don't know why he married Jean, but it wasn't for love."
"Did you talk to either one of them?"
"Talk to Sam a lot. Furnace is always kicking out on me when I need it the most. He'd come over and get it going.
When I still used to drive, he and Tyler would change the oil, check the tires, give my car a good wash. Nice people. Now, Jean, not so much.
You talked to her?
Tried to. Hard for me to get around. Got DVT, arthritis, type 2 diabetes, bad kidneys, and my liver's nothing to write home about. You name it, I probably got it. Doctor's gonna pickle me after I'm gone so they can study all the things I got wrong.
She stopped and looked questioningly at Michelle.
Brain fart, honey. Where was I?
You were trying to talk to Jean Wingo?
Michelle said helpfully.
Hell yes. Excuse my French. Now, going across that street for me is like running a marathon, but I did it more than once. Even baked her a pie to welcome her to the neighborhood, and I don't, as a rule, bake anymore because I'm just an Alzheimer's moment away from burning down the place. Now, what did she do? Took the pie, thanked me, and shut the door in my face. Another time saw her out in the yard watering the flower beds. I started over to chat with her. She looked at me like I had dog poop on my face and went inside before I got halfway across the street.
Not the friendliest of neighbors,
said Michelle in a commiserating tone.
Not a neighbor at all, least to my way of thinking.
Any idea where she might have gone?
No, but good riddance in my mind. I'm just worried about Tyler. Now that boy loves his daddy. Now his daddy's gone, and the woman his father was presumably hitched to is gone. Lots of turnover. Don't know what's coming down the pike next.
Me either,
said Michelle.
Well, thanks.
Anytime.
Dobbers squinted up at her.
Saw that feller of yours. Tyler said you were partners. Ex-super spies or some such.
Former Secret Service,
corrected Michelle.
Damn fine-looking man. If I were younger, I might be shooting for hubby number 4. Now, piece of advice.
She looked the tall Michelle up and down.
You got all the goods right where they should be. So if I were you, I'd bag and tag his cute buns, honey, before some hussy gets there first. And they will. Enough of them out there. So long. Gotta pee.
She turned and waddled back inside. Michelle just stood there, her notebook open and not a single word written on the page. She walked across the street and stared at the spot where Jean's car had been parked. Michelle had a description of the car and its tag number from seeing it earlier. She just didn't have a way to run a bolo on it. Only the cops could do that. But she agreed with Dobbers. She didn't think Jean Wingo was coming back. If Wingo's marriage had been a sham to provide cover for his mission, what was keeping her here? She pulled out her phone and called a McKinney. It went to voicemail. She left a message about meeting them that day at their office. She walked around to the back of the Wingo's house. Tyler had given her a key and permission to enter. At least that would be her story if the cops showed up. She started on the main floor and worked her way up. She didn't bother to check for prints. She had no database to run them against. That was another downside to being a private investigator. She would love to know what Jean's background was. If she'd been recruited to play a role, she might be in the military or a contractor there too. That might give them a lead on her current whereabouts. Maybe McKinney could provide that service if he agreed to team up. She took a few minutes to walk around Tyler's room. She imagined how much he was suffering, wondering whether his dad was alive or not. She hoped they could bring him some sort of resolution. She entered the Wingo's bedroom. If they were simply playing a role, she assumed the two adults were not sleeping together. Not an easy subterfuge in a house this small. She methodically searched through the bedroom and closet and didn't find anything very helpful. Jean Wingo had taken all of her clothes and apparently most of her personal possessions, since there weren't many feminine items left. No computers, no hardline phone, no cell phones. She sat in a chair in the bedroom and stared around the space, wondering if she had missed something. She looked out a window that gave her a view onto the backyard. Green trash can by the back door. She might as well go through that while she was here. She heard a loud engine and the sound of hydraulics. She peered out another window in the bedroom that looked out onto the street. The trash truck was coming down the street. She looked at the blue container on the curb. Or maybe it was a recycling truck making its rounds. The next instant, Michelle was running flat out down the stairs, out the front door, and leaping off the porch, landing on the front lawn. She reached the recycling bin seconds before the truck pulled up to collect it. When one of the men jumped off the truck's rear and eyed her, she said breathlessly,
"Lost my wedding ring in here. You can skip me this week."
She rolled the bin up the driveway and into the backyard. She closed the gate behind her and opened the top of the bin. It was half full. Michelle had realized just in time that no sane person who was about to disappear would take the time to put out the recycling. So maybe there was something in there that she needed to get rid of and didn't want possibly found on her. Maybe that was what Jean Wingo had been thinking when she'd mixed up the trash in recycling days. It took her 20 minutes of searching, but finally her hand closed around the letter, or rather, the envelope. It was addressed to Jean Shepherd, but not at this house. She folded the envelope and put it in her pocket. A minute later, she was racing down the street in her Land Cruiser. Chapter 33. Not that long ago, Sean King had been cemented in a chair next to a hospital bed in which Michelle had been lying near death. Ever since that time, he had loathed the inside of a hospital. If he could have avoided ever entering another one, he would have, but he couldn't. He had to be here. Dana was still in the critical care unit, and thus her visitors were limited to immediate family. One had to phone the unit to gain admission. He had lied and told the nurse who answered the phone that he was Dana's brother in from out of town. He was directed to her room, but stood by the door before going in. Dana was in the bed with IV and monitoring lines running all over her. The machine keeping track of her vitals hummed and beeped next to the bed. The blinds on the window were closed. The room was fairly dark. Dana wore a breathing mask, which was helping to inflate her damaged lung. He took a few hesitant steps forward, hoping he wouldn't run into General Brown here. That last thing he wanted was an altercation. His face hadn't recovered from the last beating, and though Dana wasn't conscious, he didn't think something ugly like that would help her recovery. He drew up a chair and sat next to her bed. Her chest rose and fell slowly, if unevenly. He slid a hand through the bed rails and gently gripped her wrist. She felt cold, and for one terrifying moment, he thought she was dead. But she was breathing, and the monitor showed her vitals, while weak, to still be recordable. He bent lower, his head resting lightly on the cool surface of the bed rail. He had assumed this position for over 2 weeks while waiting for Michelle to open her eyes. He had never figured to be repeating this ritual so soon, and certainly not with his ex-wife. "I'm so sorry, Dana," he said softly. He let go of her wrist and let his hand dangle. He closed his eyes and a few tears leaked out. He was startled when something touched him. When he opened his eyes, he saw that her fingers had closed around his. He looked at her face. Her eyes were still shut, her breathing still weak. He stared down at her fingers once more, thinking he must have imagined it. But there they were, intertwined around his. He didn't make a move until about 20 minutes later, when her fingers slipped off his, and she seemed to fall into a deeper slumber. He sat with her for another half hour, and then made his way out, wiping fresh tears from his eyes. He turned the corner and ran into the one person he had dreaded seeing. General Brown was not in uniform today.